Two foreign wars, a global recession, and the rise of China as a rival superpower have led some pundits to declare that America's global influence is on the decline. But before you consign America to the ash heap of history, my next guest, Robert Kagan, argues in his latest book, The World America Made, that our country's economic and military dominance is as strong as ever. Dr. Kagan is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and an advisor to Mitt Romney. His book is published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased that it brings him to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You say that talk of American decline has been prematurely overstated. You cite a pervasive narrative you call declinism. Haven't we seen this kind of talk before?
You are right. We've seen it practically almost every decade. I think most famously when Paul Kennedy wrote his famous book, The Rise and Fall of Great Powers, in 1987. In those days, we thought the Soviet Union might be passing us. Previous to that, we thought that Japan was going to pass us. Japan bought Rockefeller Center.
We're often compared to the Roman Empire.
Well, the Roman Empire lasted 600 years, and we're only 225 or so into it. But, there is something in the American psyche, I think, that goes through these periods.
But since the end of the Cold War, there hasn't been much talk of American decline. Until now, what's happening?
Well, people are obviously, they're seeing the rise of China, and the rise of China is unmistakable. Its economy is growing enormously. I think projections are it may have the world's largest economy, at least in terms of overall size, in a few years. People tend, I think, to have such a rosy, nostalgic view of American power in the past that anytime we can't get something done in the present, they see that as a sign of waning influence. As I try to point out in the book, it was always difficult wielding influence, and people have an overly optimistic sense of the past and overly pessimistic view of the present.
And you say that the international acceptance of multilateral institutions like NATO and the UN say a lot about the U.S.'s role in the world.
Yeah, I mean, the United States is really unique practically in world history in the degree of acceptance of its power in the international system. I mean, there have been times people are very unhappy about American use of force, as in Iraq and in other places, but yet how many years passed? Not many, until Barack Obama is able to use force again with the blessing of the Arab League, being invited by Europe. So America really does have enormous legitimacy.
But this has also been a partisan issue. Were you concerned when Charles Lichtenstein, then the U.S. delegate to the U.N., suggested that the U.N. members consider removing themselves and this organization from the soil of the United States? I'm quoting him. We will put no impediment in your way. The members of the U.S. mission to the United Nations will be down at the dockside waving you a fond farewell as you sail off into the sunset. Of course, he didn't realize that it's a sunrise on the Atlantic Avenue.
It's
the sunset
complicated.
Is in the Pacific.
It's complicated, but, yeah. Actually, that's not such a partisan feeling. Just recently, I think Secretary of State Hillary Clinton spoke of the United Nations Security Council being neutered as a result of Russia's and China's veto of a resolution on Syria. Displeasure with the UN is a bipartisan feeling.
So does the U.S. military still benefit from its participation in NATO? And what about the UN? We still wield a lot of power there. Do we pretty much get people to do what we want most of the time, if not all the time?
We have had a lot of success. I think that Libya was the best example. I think both China and Russia were extremely reluctant to support action in Libya, and yet they wound up being persuaded in part by the fact that the Arab League wanted to act.
But not now in Syria.
Not now in Syria. I think that right now, and this is a problem that we're going to be dealing with, Russia and China, when they look at Assad, they see themselves, especially Putin. I think Putin is not going to help the West overthrow a dictator, because I think he thinks it can come home to haunt him.
What about our participation in NATO? Isn't NATO a Cold War relic that we probably can do without today?
I don't think so, actually. I think we need to understand that there are limits to what NATO can do. I think, in fact, we spent too much time trying to get Europeans to fight in Afghanistan where they don't think it's important. But I think as a representative institution of what we used to call the West, of the transatlantic group of democracies, it still is an important institution. And I think in the future, especially if Russia gets more obstreperous, if China gets more powerful, we may look to NATO more as that kind of anchor of the West.
You say that the world has been accepting of American military power, but haven't many condemned it over the years? A reason that Yankee Go Home was so popular for so long.
Well, this that's part of my argument about how reminding people that we are not only recently unpopular, but we have been unpopular in the past. That's what people have said. There has been a lot of resentment against the United States.
Well, we've abused our power at times.
We certainly have, and we've made mistakes, and we've engaged in conflicts that perhaps we shouldn't get involved in. But, and I just think this is really important, here we were not so long ago with both the Europeans and the Arab League of all places, of all institutions, effectively begging the United States to involve itself militarily in Libya. What does that tell you? That tells you that at the end of the day, we do enjoy enormous legitimacy.
Now, you were a vocal supporter of the Iraq invasion. Do you still think it was the right thing to do? Hasn't it hurt our standing internationally?
I think it damaged our standing for a while. I think that a lot of that has passed now, because partly because of events in the Middle East, partly because of the Arab Spring, which, by the way, I think the overthrow of Saddam Hussein may have had a part. I think the fact that there were elections occurring in Iraq made neighboring countries like Egypt wonder why they weren't having elections. We definitely paid a price. I must say, however, as I look at the day, at the world today with Iran and Syria, I don't wish we still had Saddam Hussein around. He was one of the most bloodthirsty, aggressive dictators of the last part of the 20th century. I don't think we'd be better off if he were still around.
Although Iraq's future doesn't look all that rosy.
Well, I don't know. It's still an open question. I think we pulled our troops out too quickly. I think even the Obama administration thinks that the troops have left too quickly. But it's still holding together. I think we have to be attentive to it. And the truth is, it's better than it was under Saddam Hussein.
Do we expect the rest of the world to go along with us no matter what? For example, a lot of countries didn't like the idea of invading Iraq. And I remember when people in Congress were talking about freedom fries instead of French fries. Even today, sometimes we hear resentment for France. For example, Newt Gingrich has criticized Mitt Romney for knowing how to speak French, although he had to learn it because he was a Mormon missionary, not because he wanted to.
Well, are you asking about our resentment of the world or the world's resentment of us?
Well, in this case, I don't know, just knowing how to speak French seems to be a bad thing in this country. Earlier, John Kerry was hurt by it.
I honestly don't think that most Americans actually care whether someone can speak French. I think that's playing to a very narrow segment of the American population. I think that Americans understand when people are critical of us. I think, and sometimes Americans agree with the criticisms. That's one of the things. We're also self-critical.
We've been talking about America's might mostly in military terms. Is that more important than our economic might?
No, they're all, I would say that the three elements of power are all interlocking and mutually reinforcing: the military, the economic, and also the political and cultural and what people refer to as soft power. However, I think we do understate sometimes how important the military element is, because it is the undergirding of a world order that does ultimately depend on power.
But during the Cold War, the Soviet Union had arguably the second strongest military in the world after the United States, and yet it collapsed due to a dysfunctional economy and internal politics. So is military might a reliable measure of a country's health?
Well, like I said, not by itself. Obviously, you have to have a healthy economy. I think you have to have a healthy society, which is why some of the challenges that we're facing domestically are important in terms of how we move forward as a great power. I'm only saying let's not forget how important military power is as part of the equation. And you could see it now in terms of the exercise or the existence of American military power in East Asia. Look at the number of countries that are turning to the United States as they worry about China's rise. When China flexed its muscles in the South China Sea, they came to the United States not because they love Americans, but because they think American power is important to them.
And yet in Japan, there are people who are in Okinawa especially, who would like to see the Americans go.
Well, that's a local issue, and in some respects, I understand it. There have been some incidents between locals and U.S. military. But let's face it, Japan today is more pro-American than it's been in years. They are concerned about the Chinese, and they think the U.S. link is extremely important to them. Ditto in South Korea, ditto in Australia, and even in Southeast Asian countries where that hasn't always been true.
You say that without America's global predominance, the current free trade system between many industrialized nations would eventually break down. But doesn't what you call the international liberal economic order actually reinforce peaceful relations, because it requires that different countries be interdependent on each other?
It reinforces them up to a point, and I think we have to remember history a little bit. The fact that nations trade with one another does not necessarily prevent them from going to war with one another. And the best example of that is Great Britain and Germany prior to World War I. They were each other's leading trade partners. They were utterly dependent on one another for their economic well-being, and yet they managed to wind up at war. I think we have to see the economic liberal order and the power and military order as reinforcing one another. You can't have one without the other.
Reportedly, President Obama is an admirer of your work and seemed to echo you in his State of the Union address when he defended against the notion of American decline by saying, "Anyone who says that our influence is in decline or that America has waned doesn't know what they're talking about." Has President Obama's appreciation of your work come as a surprise to you?
Well, it's a pleasant surprise. It's not a big surprise. I don't think many presidents really want to run for office on the presumption of American decline or the country that they're presiding over. And I think it's understandable the president wants to say we're not in decline. What's interesting, however, is how many people, when he came to office, thought that he came to office for the purpose of managing American decline. He's clearly rejecting that, and I think that's a good thing.
Although the person you're a foreign policy advisor to, Mitt Romney, is accusing him of just that.
Well, he's accusing him of leading the United States toward decline. He points to, and I think legitimately, cuts in the defense budget, which may get deeper, some damage to some alliances around the world, pulling out prematurely from Iraq. I think that there is always reason to concern. And one of the main points of my book, even though I say we're not in decline now, we could lead ourselves to decline if we choose the wrong policies.
My guest is Robert Kagan, whose previous book was A Paradise and Power. His latest is The World America Made. It is published by Knopp. In a moment, I want to talk about cuts in defense spending. But both Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich have said at the Republican presidential debates that they would be willing to go to war to keep Iran from attaining nuclear weapons. Is that something that you've advised Mitt Romney to say?
No, I haven't discussed that particular issue with him. Look, I think that both the president and the leading Republican candidates have all said that Iran getting a nuclear weapon is unacceptable. I think everyone hopes that we can achieve this objective through sanctions, through Iran's isolation, through squeezing them. But I think, as the president himself has not ruled out the possibility of using military force.
Isn't it unclear as to whether Iran even has a nuclear weapons system? I mean, we went into Iraq sure that Saddam Hussein was building nuclear weapons, even though there was no evidence for it. And I haven't seen any evidence in Iran either. It's just a lot of hazy talk on both sides.
Actually, there is a little bit more evidence in the sense that the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, has had inspectors in Iran. They have painted a portrait of what they think is going on in Iran, which does lead to the conclusion that Iran has a weaponization program and that their nuclear efforts are not entirely peaceful. So it isn't, in this case, American intelligence. It's not European intelligence. It's the IAEA, which has been looking into this.
In your book, you say that international order is not an evolution. It's an imposition. So doesn't that mean that you're not really talking about diplomacy in any way that Iran can get something out of? I mean, we just impose what we think is best on Iran?
Well, I wasn't talking about world order in regard to a particular country. I'm talking about the fact that the reason I made that point, and it's a slightly more subtle point, I think, which is that I think a lot of people think that what is good about the international system, the widespread democracy, the economic liberalism, the lack of great power conflict, is just a natural evolution of the human species. And what I'm arguing is that this world order, like any world order, as world orders in the past, the Roman order, an Egyptian order, a European order, is imposed by the most powerful countries. And if those countries lose their power, you get a different kind of world order.
Do you think that America will eventually decline from the Pax Americana as the other great empires? Roman, I realize Roman was 600 years, but British was much briefer and not much longer than our whatever word we want to use, world dominance.
Well, of course, it may.
We
must,
have to go into decline,
whatever,
don't we,
whatever,
eventually?
What goes up must come down. I think that's a law of nations as well as physics. The question is when. I think it matters a great deal to us and to the world whether that decline comes in 10 years or 100 years. I think that the American position right now, some of it because of purely natural geographic realities, the fact that the United States is alone in the hemisphere and doesn't face any great power challenges is unique in the international system. I think that the capacity of the United States to maintain this position for quite some time to come is very great.
Well, at least, 11 years ago or 12 years ago, there was a report by the Project for a New American Century, the think tank that you co-founded with William Crystal, that stated, "No movement in international politics can be frozen in time. Even a global Pax Americana will not preserve itself." And it said that the core mission is to fight and decisively win multiple simultaneous major theater wars. Well, we haven't been doing very well with simultaneous major theater wars. And we didn't do it before Barack Obama decided to pull out of Iraq.
Well, first of all, that part of the document you're referring to was actually nothing more than a restatement of what was existing American military strategy under the Clinton administration, the so-called two-war strategy, which was the guidance for the Pentagon during the Clinton administration, which was that you had to be able to fight and win two wars simultaneously.
Now some people are saying it has to be more than two wars.
Well, I don't know who's saying that. I mean, right now the administration is moving towards saying we can only fight and win one war at a time. But, I mean, look, if you look around the world today and you ask what do our capacities have to be, you want to look at potential contingencies that might arise. And I think any strategist, Democrat, Republican, realist, idealist, what have you, will look at the Korean Peninsula and the possibility for a war there, which I think is fairly high as historical things go, the possibility that we may become involved in a conflict with Iran, not even of our own choosing, but because the Iranians themselves have provoked it, the fact that we may wind up having to use some kind of military force in Syria. I mean, all these things are real. Nobody's making them up. They're existing crises out there.
But if you look at David Frum's Axis of Evil that George Bush talked about, that was North Korea, Iran, and Iraq. The reason we went after Iraq was it was the easiest one to beat. And look at what a terrible price we have paid for that. I can't imagine going after North Korea with its nuclear weapons or Iran, which has has an incredible cultural and military history of its own.
Well, obviously, no one is looking for a war with either of those two countries. I'm certainly not. But what I'm talking about, let's just talk it through. It's not a question of the waking up one day and deciding to invade North Korea. Right now, South Korea and North Korea are in a very tense situation. The South Koreans are at a point which is new for them, that their tolerance for further North Korean actions like shelling an island and killing some civilians is very low. So if the North Koreans miscalculate and take some action, it might be the South Koreans respond in such a way that leads to war. What is your proposed action at that point? Watch them fight. We have tens of thousands of American troops in South Korea. We would be called upon. They're a military ally of the United States.
And then Dwight Eisenhower would have to come in and try to settle something on the 38th parallel.
I expect you'll be able to summon him from wherever he is to be able to do that. And, you know, in the case of Iran, it's Iran now, interestingly, talking about taking preemptive action, talking about closing the Straits of Hormuz, shadowing American ships. So, you know, it's not a question of whether we choose these things. Sometimes the international circumstances lead themselves, and it's a very difficult choice to make at that point.
And with this in mind, let's talk about military expenditures. Under the current plan, they will be cut by the formula budget reduction scheduled to go into effect next January. What impact do you see these reductions having on our military presence throughout the world?
Well, fortunately, I don't have to have an opinion on that because the opinion has been expressed by both of President Obama's secretaries of defense, Robert Gates and now Leon Panetta, that if the sequestration goes through and the defense budget is cut deeper than they have already cut it, the effect will be, quote, disastrous on the American military's capacity to do its job. That's not my opinion. That's the opinion of the Obama administration.
But aren't there some of the weapons programs that are proposed to be cut superfluous in a post-Cold War world? Where we have all these long-range bombers that really would be very effective against a Soviet threat. I mean, right now, much of the threat seems to be from groups like Al-Qaeda.
Sure, and we are engaged in a drone war against Al-Qaeda, but there are circumstances, again, where we might find ourselves in conflicts which would require those kinds of capacities. In any case, you and I could walk through all the weapon systems, but I think really your argument is with the Secretaries of Defense of the current administration. They're the ones who are saying that it will be a disaster.
And the president is going ahead despite that, you're saying?
No, I mean, I think the president does not want to have sequestration, but he's being a little bit, in my view, too lax about confronting it because, you know, this is not a mood. The country's not in a mood to hear about defense spending, and he's not in a mood to stand up for it very much.
And it also seems to be engaged in something of a game of chicken. Republicans in Congress are talking about cutting back on all sorts of programs, and so it seems to me if I were president, I'd say, okay, you want to cut those? Well, let's cut some of the things that you want as well.
Right. I mean, I could see the politics of it, and the defense budget always gets wrapped up in other issues of domestic politics. It did during the Reagan years, too.
Well, how would Mitt Romney handle this any differently?
Well, Governor Romney has said that he will not cut the defense budget in this way, and he would find other ways to find cuts. Look, I mean, to me, it's pretty obvious that defense budget is actually not where the money is if you're looking to solve our fiscal crisis. The defense budget is a tiny fraction of the problem. I've had conversations with Alice Rivlin, who is the budget chief, the CBO chief. She's a very prominent expert on the budget. She's the first to admit that the money is not coming out of the defense budget is going to solve our problem. It's coming out of entitlements. That is what is driving our fiscal crisis right now. So getting a handle on entitlements, finding the right mix of tax and spending issues is really where we have to find this problem, solve this problem, not in the defense budget.
Earlier in today's show, I talked to the author of a book called The Last Great Senate, which he says ended somewhere about when Ronald Reagan became president. And we're not blaming Ronald Reagan totally for it.
For killing the Senate.
No, but, you know, partisanship changed. There used to be a lot more cooperation. Do you think that this partisan gridlock that we are experiencing now on things like the deficit are going to undermine America's position as a world leader?
Well, that is the great question that I can't propose an answer to. I mean, in my book, I say, can we get ourselves out of this mess that we're in? The only honest answer is who knows. Historically, we have. By the way, this is not the only period in our history when we've been faced with incredible gridlock. We've been in this situation before.
Found consensus in the past, but it feels almost impossible in today's environment.
And I'm guessing it felt impossible in those environments, too. I mean, It's an interesting conundrum. The founders created a system which was going to be slow and clunky. They did so deliberately. They didn't want radical changes made in the system, so they made it difficult to make radical change. And so we have always found ourselves historically in these periods of gridlock. And yet, the system has also had the capacity to regenerate itself, usually around a critical election. And I don't know whether it would be the re-election of Obama, the election of a different president. I actually think there's a chance that the next president, whoever it is, may
Rick
have
Santorum.
Whoever it is, may have a better opportunity to solve this problem than we've had over the past 4 years.
Now, you mentioned China before, and much has been made of China's booming economy, which is expected to be the largest aggregate economy by 2025. But you say that China is only a threat, really, militarily. But China owns a lot of our debt, doesn't it?
Well, it's always a question what that means. I mean, you know, there's the old joke, if you owe your banker $100, he owns you. If you owe him $1 million, you own him. I mean, the United States and the Chinese are codependent in that way. You know, obviously, China's influence has grown tremendously and is going to continue to grow. The question that I ask is, has their geopolitical position really growing at the same time? And let me just one word about the GDP. You talked about aggregate GDP. I think it's worth remembering that China still remains a fairly poor country. Per capita GDP in the U.S. and the rest of Europe is over $40,000 a year. In China, it's $4,000 a year.
We have very little time, but what would China gain by attacking the United States?
Nothing. I don't think China seeks to attack the United States. I think China's goal is to become the dominant power in East Asia, but that's not what the rest of East Asia wants. That's why I think we're in a pretty good position.
Robert Kagan's book is called The World America Made. He is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, a columnist for The Washington Post, also the author of The Return of History and the End of Dreams, Dangerous Nation of Paradise and Power, and A Twilight Struggle. And he has served in the U.S. State Department from 1984 to 1988. Thank you so much for being with us today to talk about this book.
Thank you very much for having me.